6, I was elected a fellow at Magdalen College, Oxford, and hence my career as a scholar and tutor began. About this time, one of my fellow tutors, the hardest boiled atheist I'd ever known, sat in my room on the other side of the fireplace and remarked, "Oh, the evidence for the historicity of the Gospels. Surprisingly good. Rum thing, all that mythology about dying gods. Rum thing. Looks as if it really happened once." I was shattered. If he, the cynic of cynics, who's never since shown any interest in Christianity, were not, as I still would have put it, safe, where could I turn? Before God closed in on me, I was in fact offered a moment of free choice. I was sitting on a bus going up Headington Hill thinking I was wearing a suit of armor, trying to keep something out. I could unbuckle the armor or keep it on. The choice felt momentous. I chose to unbuckle. It did not seem possible to do the opposite. The initiative did not lie with me. If Hamlet and Shakespeare could ever meet, it would have to be Shakespeare's doing. He could write himself into the play. What I called spirit began to show an alarming tendency to become personal. Into my mind crept a horrible novelty. I really believe something. And now that I had blundered into that, I knew I could play at philosophy no longer. It was time something should be done. The absolute had arrived, making a nuisance of itself, issuing a command. All my acts and desires were to be brought in line with this absolute spirit that I now believed. For the first time, I examined myself with a serious, practical purpose. What I found appalled me. Depth after depth of pride, self-admiration, a zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. Oh, my name is Legion. Oh, amiable agnostics, talk cheerfully of man's search for God. May as well talk about the mouse's search for the cat. All I ever wanted was not to be interfered with, to call my soul my own. Keep out, private. This is my business. Let no one talk glibly about the comforts of religion. Or is it a small thing to give yourself blindly to a guide who on his own showing may very well be leading you to poverty, ridicule, death? Oh, I knew I would not allow myself to do anything intolerably painful. I would be reasonable. Would it be reasonable? No assurance was offered. It was all or nothing. As the dry bones are shook in Ezekiel's dreadful valley, the absolute spirit began to stir and heave and throw off its grave clothes. He said, I am the Lord. I am that I am. I am. You must picture me alone in my room at Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted, even for a second, from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of Him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term 1929, I gave in and admitted that God is God, knelt and prayed perhaps that night, the most dejected, reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see the divine love that would accept a prodigal on such terms. Kicking, struggling, resentful, darting his eyes in every direction, looking for a chance to escape. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of man. His compulsion is my liberation. You must understand that the conversion I just described was only to theism, pure and simple, not Christianity. I knew nothing of the incarnation. The God to whom I surrendered was not human. I had no belief in an afterlife. That to me felt like a bribe. I did begin prayer, but at the time it felt like posting letters to a non-existent address. Oh, I suppose that was a dead weight of old skeptical habits, because all of my reasonable mind was convinced that the universe cannot explain itself, that God is behind the universe, that He has purposes and is to be obeyed simply because He is God. My religion was like that of the Jews. As soon as I became a theist, I started attending my parish church on Sunday and college chapel during the week, not because I believed in Christianity, but because I thought one should fly one's flag. Oh, church was an unattractive affair. I like clergy, as I like bears, but I have no more wish to be in church as to be in a zoo. Church to me meant ugly architecture, ugly music, bad poetry. Hymns are extremely disagreeable to me. And the botheration of it all, the crowds, the notices, the perpetual organizing. But now that I believed in God, I wanted to know more of Him from any source, pagan or Christian. The perplexing number of religions began to sort itself out. The question was no longer to find the one true religion among many, but where had the thing grown up? Paganism was a childhood of religion. Where had it reached maturity? Well, as for materialism, I was no longer concerned. Their view was out of court. If reason is only the accidental result of atoms colliding in skulls, I see no reason why I should believe one accident should give the correct account of all other accidents. Oh, it's like asking spilt milk on the floor to give the correct account of the jar it came from and why it was spilt. No, my allegiance was now with the mass of humanity who had danced, sang, prayed, worshipped. there isn't really an infinite variety of religions, you know. To me, the only ones worth considering were Christianity and Hinduism. Islam is only the greatest of the Christian heresies. Buddhism is only the greatest of the Hindu heresies. All that is best in Judaism and in Plato survives in Christianity. And Hinduism bears no historical claim. Oh, that had been put into my head by that hard-boiled atheist who said, all that mythology about dying gods looks as if it really happened once. One day, Tolkien and I took a stroll on Addison's Walk. As we talked, I said, Tollers, I have, with considerable resistance, come to believe in God. But not Christianity. I simply cannot believe something I do not understand. How can the life and death of someone else, whoever he was, 2,000 years ago, help us here and now? Toller's answered, Jack, when you meet a god sacrificing himself in a pagan story, such as Dionysius or Balder, or even a fairy tale, you like it very much and are mysteriously moved by it, provided you meet it anywhere except in the Gospels. Jack, the story of Christ is a myth, working on us in the same way as other myths, with one tremendous difference. It really happened. Suddenly, a rush of wind interrupted us, startling me. So many leaves fell to the ground, I thought it was raining. I held my breath. Tollers and I talked deep into the night. Hugo Dyson joined us. They convinced me that nothing else in all literature is just like the Gospels, and that no person is like the person they depicted. When I would bring this up, my colleagues would say, Jack, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I simply cannot accept his claim to be God. Huh. How could a mere man be called a great moral teacher and say the sorts of things Jesus said? That he always existed, that he will come again to judge the world. Chesterton wrote that no great moral teacher ever claimed to be God. Not Moses, not Muhammad, not Plato, not Buddha, not one. If you had gone to Buddha and asked, are you the son of Brahma? He would have said, my son, you are still in the veil of illusion. If you had gone to Socrates and asked, are you Zeus? He would have laughed at you. And if you had gone to Muhammad and asked, are you Allah? He would first tear his clothes, then cut your head off. No great moral teacher ever made that claim. Except Jesus. And he went on claiming to forgive sins. And that he himself is the injured party in every transgression? In anyone else, this would be thought silly. Suppose you told me that two of your colleagues had lost you a professorship by telling lies about your character, and I replied, I freely forgive them both. Oh, would you not think that sheer lunacy? And yet even those who opposed him admitted that he expressed moral truth with depth and purity, full of wisdom and shrewdness. He calls himself humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that humility and meekness are the last things you would ascribe to a man who makes claims worthy of a megalomaniac. Kirk taught me to shame inconsistency. If Jesus' statements are false, Christianity is of no importance. If true, it is of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is moderately important. Oh, I felt a resistance to this, almost as strong as my resistance to theism. Every step from the absolute to spirit to God was a step toward the more concrete. And now, to accept the incarnation, that God became man, was a further step in the same direction. This too was something I had not wanted. I remember very well when, but hardly how, the final step was taken. I was being driven by my brother Warney to Whipsnade Zoo in the sidecar of a motorcycle one sunny morning in the autumn of 1931. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. When we reached the zoo, I did. I had not spent the journey in thought or great emotion. It was more like a man who, after long sleep, has become aware he is now awake. My conversion shed new light on my search for joy. The overwhelming longings that emerged from fantasties and my brother's toy garden were merely signposts to what I really desired. They were not the thing itself. I concluded that if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world could satisfy, the most probable explanation is I was made for another world. The faint, far-off results of those energies which God's creative rapture implanted in matter when he made the world are what we now call physical pleasures. And even thus filtered, they are too much for our present management. What will it be like to taste at the fountainhead that stream of delight which even the smallest drop proves so intoxicating? That, I now believe, is what lies before us. We are to drink joy at the fountain of joy. At present, we're on the outside of that world, the wrong side of the door. We cannot mingle with the splendors we see. But all the leaves of the New Testament rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. One day, God willing, we shall get in. Meanwhile, the cross comes before the crown. And tomorrow is another morning. A cleft has opened in the pitiless walls of this world, and we have been invited to follow our great captain inside. Following him is, of course, the essential point. That Christmas, I took the short walk to my parish church. That walk marked the end of one journey and the beginning of another. As I sat in the pew and looked around, I thought not only of my own potential glory hereafter, but also of that of my neighbor's glory. Oh, it is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest, most uninteresting person you meet may one day be a creature that if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror, or a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities that I should now conduct all my dealings. There are no ordinary people. I have never met a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as that of a gnat. It is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, exploit. The weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid daily on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. At the close of the service, they read from the Book of Common Prayer, Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast. I got up from my pew, walked to the front, knelt, and received the bread and the wine, the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. Unlike my first communion 17 years earlier, I now believe.